Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History, part of the New Books Network series of podcasts. I'm on the channel today with Nancy Sinkoff, professor at Rutgers University, and we're actually talking about Eastern European and Jewish history together all at once in her new book, which is an intellectual biography, the first comprehensive one of the historian Lucy S. Davidovich, called From Left to Right, Lucy S. Davidovich, The New York Intellectuals and the Politics of Jewish History. This is a book which is just released and published by Wayne State University Press in 2020. Welcome to our podcast, Nancy.
Thank you, Stephen. So happy to be here or be in cyberspace, whatever we're doing.
I think we're in the virtual world here, but the virtual world of actual history. So let me read your bio. Nancy Sinkoff is the academic director of the Bildner Center for the Study of Jewish Life, and she's an associate professor of Jewish studies and Rutgers history at Rutgers, New Brunswick. Her specializations are in early modern and modern Jewish history, East European Jewish intellectual history, both in the Polish heartland and in its diasporic settlements, the Enlightenment, politics, and gender. And her books include, for instance, Out of the Shtetl, Making Jews Modern in the Polish Borderlands, published in 2004, which has recently been reissued digitally with a new preface by Brown University's Judaic Studies series, an excellent series. And Nancy has received many numerous fellowships from the Mellon Foundation, from Fulbright, from the ACLS, and so on. In 2016, 2017, she was the Elizabeth J. Dilworth Professor in Historical Studies at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton University. So I'm really excited to hear Professor Sinkoff about Lucy Davidovich, who is such an important historian and never uncontroversial. And I want to start with the first question, really, which is more about you than about Lucy Davidovich. And that is, you mention reading her memoir way back in 1989, and you were actually very much involved in the reissuance of her memoir in 2008. So how does her career, her life, her works, her letters track with your own intellectual journey?
Well, thanks for the question. You know, I think that's always a big one for historians. You know, do we choose our subjects or do they choose us? And trying to really suss that out is complicated. In many ways, this sounds perhaps odd to speak as a rational historian, but I think that in this case, I was kind of meant to do this book. My work has always focused on the intellectual and cultural responses of the Jews of Eastern Europe to the modern period. That's what has guided everything I've written. And that's a big, big topic. It begins with the Enlightenment, with the late 18th century, when Poland is partitioned, and the majority of the Jews of Europe, who are Polish Jews, are thrust into an encounter with the modern state, both imperial and then sometimes the nation state, and begin this long process as yet unresolved and unfinished in becoming moderns and becoming modern Europeans. And then later, with the migrations and challenges to the 20th century, modern Americans and modern Palestinian Jews and then Israeli Jews and modern Soviet Jews. So that's the arc of modern East European Jewish history. And that has always been what has motivated my historical research. So this book, which is an intellectual cultural biography of Lucy Davidovich, is in fact, for me, yet another exploration of that of those very big questions, which is how do Jews from the East European heartland become modern? And in her case, it's in the 20th century. But the questions that I believe her life tries to address, the life that she lived and that she thought about, and the context around her, are the same kinds of questions that have motivated my work as an historian when I looked at the 18th century. And those questions, and there are others, but some of the most enduring ones are, what is the relationship to Jewish identity, to Jewish languages, and particularly to Yiddish, which was the vernacular of the Jews of Eastern Europe, and the vernacular of Jews in the East European Jewish diasporas, whether they lived in South Africa, Buenos Aires, Winnipeg, New York, Paris, you know, the Pletzel, wherever they lived, the Jews of Eastern Europe brought their language. So that's one question. The other is, what? How does modernity create political vulnerability for Jews in new ways, already the land of the 18th century, and how do Jews respond politically to no longer living under noble patronage or under the protection of a king, right? Now they're part of the evolution of modern state building and politics, be it imperial or nation state democratic politics. And where do Jews fit in the new politics, and how do they understand their own political evolution? So that's a, again, enduring question dating from the late 18th century to the present. How do Jews maintain a sense of groupness, funny word, or collective identity or nationalism with a lowercase n, right? How do Jews retain their sense of a cohesive group identity in societies where the structure of politics and life privilege individualism and the unhinging of collective ties? That's, again, an enduring question. What is the role of traditional Jewish life, of Judaism, in the shaping of modern Jewish identity? What does one hold onto? What does one discard as one becomes modern? So all of those questions, and there are probably a few others that I could throw in, but for the sake of time, I won't. In my mind, those are the questions of modern Jewish life. They continue today, regardless of the creation of a sovereign nation state in the Middle East, regardless of the efflorescence of Jewish life in the United States. These are still, to my mind, the enduring questions that any Jewish intellectual or someone thinking about Jewish life in ideological intellectual terms is going to grapple with. And so Lucy Davidovich was a perfect vehicle for me to get at that question, at those questions. And that's why I wrote her biography. So it's less, it is about her, but it's about how she grappled with those questions in a pre and then a post-genocidal, you know, the post-Holocaust world in the United States. So those are the questions that always spoke to me, and she was my way to get into them in the 20th century.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on many of these questions. I hope we can cover as many of these seminal questions as possible, because they really do get to the heart not only of Jewish history and Jewish intellectual life, but also the 20th century. So let me start with the pre-genocidal period, her life before the Shoah. What was her life like in interwar Eastern Europe as a Yiddishist and as the wartime researcher before she got married, Lucy Schildkret? What did she do, and what was her, let's say, intellectual and political milieu like?
So I think that, you know, you said it quietly, but it's pretty important. This woman does not become Lucy S. Davidovich until 1948. So she's already 33 years old. So I think it's not just a hook. It's actually true. The Polish name that sort of defines her as the voice of the destroyed culture of Polish Jewry is a name that she gets only when she marries her husband, Szymon Davidovich, who was indeed a Warsaw-born Yiddishist, and he was a refugee. He left in 1940. He was a Bundist. He was politically on the left. and she meets him in the interwar year. She meets him during the war years. I'll get to that in a second, and then marries him when she comes back from her second sojourn in Europe. So that's important. Until from 1915 until 1948, she's someone else, if you will. She is Lucy Schildkat, or by the her Yiddish name, she's Liba Schildkat. And so the milieu in which she is raised is the milieu of immigrant New York, East European immigrant New York, and Yiddish culture. And the book positions her in historical conversation with the famous male Jewish intellectuals, New York intellectuals, many of whose names are far better known than hers. People like Irving Kristol, Norman Podhoretz, Nathan Glaser, Lionel Trilling, Irving Howe, Alfred Kazin, Milton Himmelfarb to some degree. I position her in conversation with them, but someone who grappled with questions of Jewish political liberalism and leftism, was involved with the emergence of neoconservatism, creation of Holocaust consciousness, reflecting on cosmopolitanism, all these major questions of Jewish integrationism in the 20th century. But she's distinct from them, and this is part of the milieu question. She's distinct from them by two very seminal features. One is that she's a woman or she's a girl. So her trajectory as a public figure is gendered, is shaped by the gender constraints that informed women's lives in the 20th century. That's A. And B, and as important, is that she's actually educated as a Yiddishist. So she's not merely someone, and I'm not dismissing those people, but she's not someone who absorbed immigrant culture just because it's around her, sort of in a passive way. Her parents chose to send her to a supplementary Yiddish school, which was affiliated with something called the Sholem Aleichem Folk Institute. There were four supplementary Yiddish school movements in the interwar years in New York. Three of them were quite ideological. One was associated with the Zionists. It's called the Falband. The other was associated with the socialist movement. That's called the Albatel Ring, the Workman's Circle. And the third was associated with the communists after the break with the socialists in 1921, and that was called the International Albatel Olden, or the IWO. And all of these groups, particularly the Albatel Ring and the IWO, had a whole network of institutions that we would now call secular ethnic institutions. They were schools for their children, credit associations, summer camp, orchestras, a press, and all in the vernacular language of the Jews of Eastern Europe, that is Yiddish. The Sholem Aleichem Folk Institute was nonpartisan. It was established in reaction to the harnessing of ideology to Yiddish culture or to Yiddishism. So it was ideologically what we call diaspora nationalism. And that is a movement that was again born in Eastern Europe in the imperial context, which argues that Jews are a nation, Jews are a people, and they have the right to demand group rights in an imperial context, and those group rights include language, education, and culture. So those were that's the diaspora nationalism of the Sholem Aleichem Folk Institute, and she was educated in that movement. That meant after school, after going to elementary school, she went to a Yiddish school called a shula. On the weekends in high school, she went down to Union Square from the Bronx to go to the Mittelschule, the high school. And she went to the summer camp, and she was a counselor there. And the camp was called Camp Boibelik, which was named after a place in Sholem Aleichem's fiction. And Camp Boibelik, in her years, was completely in Yiddish, right? This is a summer camp where kids spoke, danced, laughed, you know, and had romances all in Yiddish. So this shapes her, and she chooses to have it part of her life. And I think that makes her very distinct from this other group, this male, it happened to be men, the male group of New York intellectuals, for whom Yiddish culture was much more passive. Irving Howe is the outlier there, and we can talk about him perhaps if there's time. But for the rest of them, Bell and Glaser, and they don't really, they're not cultivating Yiddish culture in the interwar years. She is, and then she makes the fateful decision, encouraged by the great Polish Jewish historian, Yaakov Szatsky, who is an immigrant and teaching in his spare time in this Yiddish school movement, she makes the fateful decision to become a research fellow at the YIVO Institute, the Yiddish Wissenschaftliche Institut, in Vilna, Poland, which is in the borders of interwar Poland. And she goes there to be associated with the YIVO, to be a graduate fellow, and to be in a cohort of young people studying Yiddish culture, Yiddish language, Yiddish philology, linguistics, anthropology, less history. That was based more in Warsaw, but she was interested in history. And the central figure there is someone named Max Weinreich. And Max Weinreich is a Yiddish linguist, and he is really the head of the Aspirantur, that's the research fellowship, and really the person with Zelig Kalmanovich, another YIVO activist, to become absolutely central to her identity as she emerges as what, you know, in training as a Yiddish intellectual. But she's an American. And that means her experience in Vilna from 1938 to 1939 is always shaped by the fact that she has an out, right? She has an American passport. So while the drums of war are beating, although no one knew what this war would mean when the Germans invaded on September 1st, 1939, and then when the Soviets moved in from the east on September 17th, of the same year, of same month, no one knew what it would mean. But once the Hitler-Stalin Pact was signed, the American government sent out a letter to nationals abroad and said, you need to come home. There's going to be a war. And her friends also pushed her and said, go, you're an American. You don't know what it's like to be here. We've lived through a war. So she takes a rather harrowing and rather historically amazing train trip from Vilna to Warsaw to Berlin, which is now completely under Nazi control, to Copenhagen, and gets back to the United States. And then during the war, she worked at the New York YIVO, and there's a whole story there, but this is a branch of the Vilna Institution, and it is a skeletal institution, but Max Weinreich, whom I mentioned before, has also gotten out. So he does everything to maintain the YIVO and to sort of shift its locus to New York. And there are many refugee scholars who are extremely important who get out and also inhabit the world of the New York YIVO. People like Elias Cherokova, Raphael Mahler had come earlier. Shimon Davidovich, her future husband gets out. He's a Bundist. He's a copy editor at the YIVO. And a whole host of other people. And she ends up working at the YIVO as Max Weinreich's secretary during the war. And this means, and this is quite important, that as part of the American Jewish community that's reading and writing in Yiddish, they are more aware than most Americans of what's going on in Eastern Europe, because they are still getting letters from loved ones and family, and they have people on the ground, even the Jewish left and the Jewish Labor Bund, who are sending information as long as they can about what's happening to the Jews of Eastern Europe. And so they're much more aware than everyone else of what's going on. And her milieu is completely tied now. That's, I think, what's important, tied to the fate of East European Jewry in ways that many other people are not. And then she goes back to Europe. But go ahead, pose your question. I can continue.
I'm struck by in your biography by her American and American Jewish identity, because the emigre culture in New York, especially, is just so strong. There's the Frankfurt School. There's the reading of Hannah Arendt. The Origins of Totalitarianism is published, I believe, in 1951, and she has a quite different trajectory, right? Because as an immigrant born in 1915, she went to Eastern Europe just before the war broke out, and then she becomes institutionally involved and intellectually involved both with YIVO and the American Jewish Committee in the 1950s. So I want to sort of lead into the next question, which really is after this formative period from 1939 to 1948 ends. Could you mention her work institutionally, both with YIVO and with the AJC? How is this important in her life, and how does she
I absolutely will. I just want to mention one sort of the 18 months after the war, because that's very important. That book ends. Just also in terms of a plug about how I wrote the book, I wrote this book as a transnational biography. And we're often thinking about transnationality in one direction, sort of from some place of origin to America. But what I try to argue in this book is that transnationality goes both ways, right? So she is born in an immigrant family and goes to Eastern Europe, comes back to the United States, goes back to German lands and comes back to the United States. So her transnationality is like is two-streeted, you know, whatever the expression is. It's two ways. And I think that we need to think more about that, about intellect. And I know this, colleagues who've written on African American history, you know, civil rights activists who go to Ghana, you know, it changes you to go to these places. It affects the way you read the history of your own homeland. I argue in the latter part of the book, this is going off into another tangent, forgive me, but that she sort of misreads America because of her East Europeanness later in her life. But getting back to what I wanted to mention. So after in 1943, and this is very significant, you know, the destruction of the Warsaw Ghetto, you know, everyone at YIVO, you can imagine what it was like for them. Shimon Davidovich, her future husband, had a wife and two children. His daughter was a ghetto fighter, you know, and they realized that they had all perished. And there's an important beginnings of this commemorative process, which people don't realize already during the war, people who, Yiddishists and Jews from Eastern Europe who are aware of what has happened, they already are starting to commemorate what they called was the Horben, right, the destruction. She goes back to Europe to work with the Joint Distribution Committee. And this in some ways is going to play a link into the American Jewish Committee work, because the Joint is the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. And it was formed already or much earlier during World War I. And it's a global Jewish help organization. And when she gets to the American occupied zone of post-war Germany, she's working with a whole host of many women, actually, very interesting, from all over the Jewish world who've come to help the refugees. And this is a very important part of her life, because she, first of all, has the direct encounter with survivors, some of whom are Polish Jews who have survived in hiding. Some of them been through the camps. Some of them were in Siberia. And also she's working under the auspices of an official NGO in the American zone, which means she's almost like a civilian army person, you know, sort of a lay army. You know, she's got a uniform. It's all very structured. So she's not inducted into the army like men were, but she's sort of acting in that way as sort of part of American. I'm loath to say imperial power at this moment, but in that structure, right, of the post-war years. But she's working directly with refugees, and she begins to help the historical commission. She does translations from Yiddish. So all the activities that will make her a fine historian later, and particularly the idea that the voices of the victims themselves must be heard, it's a nascent form of that training. And she's also, interestingly, in the British zone of post-war Germany, where the refugees from the Exodus are disembarked. And she actually chooses not to write about that in her autobiography, which raises very interesting questions. She ends her autobiography with the rescue and salvaging of Jewish cultural treasures that belong to the YIVO and to the libraries of Vilna and their shipment back to New York, which is going to create the repository of archival riches now in New York from East European Jewish past, and she is seminally important in that activity. So all of this is the first two parts of the book, part one, be an American, part two, becoming a European. That's how I write the book. Part one is, you know, American immigrant daughter, and two is to Europe. But then she comes home in 1947 and marries soon thereafter. And then the next section of the book, part three, I call becoming an American, even though, of course, she holds an American passport, but she becomes an American. Now, why do I say that? Because she goes to work for the American Jewish Committee. The American Jewish Committee was one of, after the JDC, one of the most important Jewish advocacy agencies in the United States, but it was founded by Jews of Central and German culture. It is an organization that denationalizes, with a lowercase n, the Jewish experience. They view Jews as a religion. And this was part of the modernization of German Jews in 19th century Europe, where you have the beginning of the separation of church and state, a slow, steady process, finally a political emancipation in German lands in 1871. And Jews of German origin or German descent do not view their Jewishness in ethnic secular terms, or not what we in Eastern Europe would call a national term, right? They view it as a religion. Jews are a confession. They're nationally American, and they're confessionally Jewish. And we see this in France. I mean, there's a long history to this. But that was the world that she inhabited. And here she is, an East European Jew for whom Jewishness is ethnic and cultural and Yiddish speaking and civilizational, if I can. I imagine she felt like a fish out of water a little bit.
Is she religious in that context, Nancy?
No.
It's a really hard thing to answer because she is insisting on the voices of Jewish people as a group. So does her modernization become a turn toward religion? What does the evidence show for that?
Yeah, so it's only later. In terms of her own personal, like the most interior part of her life, she is disquieted, I would say, already in the interwar years by the assumption that secular Jewish life has a future. Because the evidence that she sees in Vilna, and we know this true of New York as well, you know, the Jewish immigrants who were secular, the next generation of children did not have the bedrock of secularism that they did. And the obstacles to integration, at least in the New York diaspora, are much lower. And Yiddish language is being assimilated into English in the American context. In Poland, Jews are Polonizing linguistically, right? So the future, Max Weinreich already, everyone is aware that the children, and you know, if you're a Jewish kid in 1938, you may or may not really know Yiddish. You could be going to a school that's instruction is in Polish. So the question of the viability of the secularist project based in Yiddish language and culture for the Jewish future is already thoughtful people, I would say, are examining that, and thoughtful people that she cares about, particularly Zella Kalmanovich and someone named Leiba Schler. So she's, I would say, disquieted by the assumption that the Jewish future can be guaranteed, if you will, Jewish groupness can be guaranteed through secularism. But she's not, quote, religious. She's has not been raised in a home with religious ritual. It is uncomfortable to her. She says that very clearly in her autobiography, her memoir. And her husband, remember, is really a card-carrying socialist. So for him, it's very difficult. What will later be her movement towards certain aspects of religious life. Right. So part of being at the American Jewish Committee and this issue of religion is that the American Jewish Committee is a foot soldier in the construction of Cold War liberalism and the fight against what is perceived as, which is real atheistic totalitarianism. Right. So the Soviet Union is not only the enemy because it's anti-democratic, right? It's the enemy because it's a language that's faithless. So the American Jewish Committee, in fighting this Cold War, cultural Cold War, is going to emphasize the religiousness of Jews, which fits in with the American fabric of group identity. So I imagine that Lucy Davidovich is absorbing all of this, even if it's quite unfamiliar to her. She's not someone who from her background, would have associated Jewish religion as the defining feature of what Jews should do and be. But she's in an institution where that's how Jewish groupness is understood. And it's understood as being harmonious with American liberalism. So the American Jewish Committee is involved with fighting the fight for the separation of church and state because they believe that religion is something that people should do. The state should not do it. But America allows it to flourish. So that's what they support. And she's doing a lot of the research on the court cases in the 50s that are church-state court cases, which have to do with release time, federal funding for textbooks, school vouchers. Many issues that we see playing out today are being negotiated in the courts already in the 50s in the context of the Cold War. So this is really where I argue she becomes an American because she supports the separation of church and state, but is beginning to identify religion as a marker of group identity and the necessity of Jews to pay more attention to supporting religious life, which is antithetical to her secularist background. She's also a fierce anti-communist, which she already was after her youthful dalliance with the Young Communist League. The Moscow trials seem to have, you know, expelled her or propelled her out of that. And then living in Vilna with people who had fled the Soviet Union, she just hates the Bolsheviks and also believes that Bolshevism and universalist ideology doesn't allow for Jewish distinctiveness. So she is an anti-communist, and she's also very involved with the American Jewish Committee's civil rights agenda, which is extremely powerful and very important. The whole idea of intergroup relations, that America will be good for Jewish integration if Jews fight on the behalf of other minority groups. This is a fundamental component of the American Jewish Committee in those years. And it's only towards the mid to late 60s where people begin to ask whether or not the fight for civil rights is in the long-term interests of Jewish group identity. And that's part of what is the last part of my book, which is her, where she brings her East European groupness to the American political landscape, and they don't meet very well together.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So that's where I really want to talk about a lot of the relationships that she had and the network that she had within the New York community, especially. Because at one point in your book, I found this fascinating. You describe her as an intellectual tomboy. So there is this process of professionalization for her when Holocaust history really takes off through the 1960s and 1970s. She is becoming a professional woman. And at the same time, she's also a professional woman who shuns slogans like in the 1970s, the personal as the political. And in her relationships, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I see almost like concentric circles to her life. Like there is an inner circle of friends where she cares about them dearly. And then there's kind of like an outer circle of intellectuals and intellectual acquaintances, some of whom are allowed into her innermost circles. Can you talk about then her relationships as you see them through her writings, her letters, and maybe what changed about them through the 60s and 70s?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for that question, because I think in a way, if I had posed that question the way you just did, which I want to, again, give a shout out for it, I wonder if the book would look different. So that's interesting to me to think about that, like the road I didn't take, so to speak. I think these relationships are extremely important to her, but I didn't really write a book about it. It's more implicit than explicit. But I think you're 100% right, is that certainly from the mid 60s until her death, or particularly after the death of her husband, he dies in 1979, her intimate circle becomes smaller, right? Her intimate circle becomes smaller. There are people whom she trusts, and she's a wonderful friend too. I mean, I did interview people, and people talked about what an incredible friend she was, if you were beloved by her. And then there are the associates, and then there's the world, the bigger world. And the bigger world in the late 60s, early 70s becomes a world that she thinks is deeply problematic. So she's so critical of the New Left, critical of the counterculture, critical of feminism, critical of the perception that the academy is being taken over by what was then, they didn't call it political correctness, but an agenda of grievances. So these things are, she's displeased with those things, and they lead to, again, a sort of inwardness, and also her right-wing shift, right, to defending, you know, the good old days of sort of meritocracy and universalism and a canon and things like this. So I think your insight about that is right on. I would say that her relationships, she seeks in some ways male father figures throughout her life, although she has some very close female friends. I don't want to say she doesn't, but the men in her life were the father figures were extremely important. So her father, she was closer to her father than to her mother, but she had a difficult relationship with her mother, but her father, a closer relationship. And I think she mourned him more. But when I think about her whole life, she was extremely attached to Max Weinreich. She was extremely attached to Yakov Shatsky. She was extremely attached to Leibish Lehrer, extremely attached to Zella Kalmanovich in Vilna. And then after the war, she marries her husband. Again, he's 20 years older than she is. So she marries Shimon Davidovich, again, an older Jewish man of East European origin. And then at the American Jewish Committee, she befriends and becomes very close to Milton Himmelfarb, a very important writer and researcher at the committee. Norman Podhoretz, who is the editor of Commentary Magazine, which in its heyday was an extremely important magazine of Jewish culture, life, and politics. And she wrote lots and lots. She wrote over 50 articles for Commentary. She gets to know the sociologist, Marshall Sklar, very important to her in terms of introducing her to thinking about American Jews and sociology. All of these men are extremely important to her. And then as she moves towards a more conservative or religiously inflected or observant inflected life, certain rabbinic figures. Well, Abraham Joshua Heschel, by the way, whom she knew as a refugee who was involved with the Yivo and Yiddish when he first came to this country, later becomes not only a civil rights activist, but an instructor at the Jewish Theological Seminary. Heschel is very, very important. But she also becomes very close to someone named David Mirsky, to Gerson Cohen. David Mirsky is at Yeshiva University, employs her to start teaching the first courses in 1969, what later became courses on the Holocaust. David Mirsky is very important to her. Gerson Cohen is the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, Rabbi Saul Berman, Rabbi Harlan Wexler. So she, throughout her life, I think she's looking for certain kinds of father figures, and those relationships shape her, and she chooses them. You know, she chooses people whom she respects. But she does have a cohort of female friends, so I don't want to dismiss that. She has a lifelong friendship with a British doctor whom she met in the DP camp, someone named Pearl Ketcher, extremely interesting woman who lost her husband to natural causes, but during World War II. Pearl emigrates from after working in the DP camps to Mandatory Palestine, and then lives in Israel her whole life. Her brother Moshe is a journalist. Another brother starts the Israeli Press Agency. So these are sort of founding individuals. Pearl and Lucy are lifelong friends. I have, you know, scores of letters between them. And she also becomes friendly with sort of an important group of what I would say female writers who tend towards the right-wing perspective. Cynthia Ozick, Ruth Weiss, Joanna Kaplan, Norma Rosen, Jewish writers who are writing about the Jewish experience, writing about America, and they're not public intellectuals because they're literary figures. And they are sort of her inner, and Francine Klagsbrunn, very important Francine Klagsbrunn. These are relationships that are very important to her. So I hope I addressed your question about these relationships.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about her work. So I think the relationships are extraordinary. And I'm very glad for our listeners here on New Books Network that Wayne State University Press published the letters. There is a magnificent appendix in your book, including correspondences, which are remarkable, including like with Albert Einstein. So, you know, for future researchers who are looking into everything that she wrote, aside from the autobiography, that's excellent. I think that's wonderful for both students and for researchers. I do want to ask about Holocaust history and historiography. And this really is, you know, about her belligerence and her writing with Commentary and maybe steadfastness could be the right word. Stodginess has a bit of a negative connotation, but you know, I mean, she does through the 70s, and especially when she becomes involved in the creation of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, have a number of very important quarrels with Holocaust historians. So how does your reading of her earlier life, becoming European and becoming an American, then dovetail with her later reputation as a Holocaust historian and historiographer of a particular school?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's all of a piece. You know, this is always the risk one runs as a historian, right? Do we see contradictions or do we see seamlessness? You know, and sometimes I think it's temperamental, right? Certain scholars see, you know, always see the fissures, and others see coherence. I guess guilty as charged. I tend to see coherence. In Lucy Davidovich's case, I think the best way to understand her, and I have a chapter coming out entitled this way, I call her Dubnov's other daughter. And by Dubnov's other daughter, I mean Shimon Dubnov's other daughter. So Shimon Dubnov was the great Russian Jewish historian of the 19th century who famously charged the Jewish people to collect their own sources, to write their own history, to consider history their birthright. And he saw history writing as part of national collective identity. And that was the way to ensure some kind of, again, this word groupness, which is not such a great word, but I'm so loath to use the word nationalism, particularly because, you know this, Stephen, as an East Europeanist, it doesn't mean what it always means in our contemporary context.
No, it doesn't. I think of Brubaker's work on groupism, right. You know, and the unmixing of nations, it really does have a negative context. So it does signify belonging.
Right. So, and people seem to forget in the 19th century, particularly for what I call ethnic linguistic, I call the Jews an ethnic linguistic urban majority in Eastern Europe, right? But groupness, fighting for it, was part of a different pathway to state building. And we all know this. We East Europeanists know this. And Dubnov is a liberal. He's a liberal politically. He actually has great hope for what's going to be the playing out of Jewish history in Eastern Europe, which is why he stays. I mean, Dubnov could have left, and he stays, and then tragically he's murdered in the ghetto of Riga at the age of 80. So, I mean, he's the great example of a devoted liberal and a devoted modern Jewish nationalist with a lowercase n, and who had utter faith in the possibility of the diaspora and utter faith in the possibility of Jewish collective identity. And that's what motivates her. That's what she does as an historian. And I think that's where we, looking back, you know, people say, well, should we read her books now? You know, what do they teach me about the Holocaust? Well, I still think they teach one facts things about the Holocaust. But I think more importantly, they teach us what it was like in her moment to write a history of the Holocaust that included the voices of the victims. You know, we take it for granted now. I mean, now, you know, we've kind of gone full circle where we think testimonies are authentic. Well, I don't need to tell you that after the war, most people working on the destruction of the Jews thought testimonies were too selective, or they were biased, or they were problematic. I mean, I have a colleague who is a really fine historian who wrote, you know, an article about one of the survivors of Babi Yar, the 2-day massacre, 3-day massacre of the Jews outside Kiev. 33,000 Jews were mowed down. Dina Prochnicheva, I don't want to get her name wrong, survives. She gave her testimony 12 times. They're contradictions. So the question is, you know, how legitimate is it? From my own perspective, she may have, in this case, the testimony may have made mistakes here and there, but certain things are consistent in the testimony, and therefore we should take as fact, quote unquote. So Lucy Davidovich, very much influenced by Dubnov, influenced by the historian Philip Friedman, who I haven't mentioned here, and I should. He's a survivor historian, extremely important, although they tangled personally. You know, he survives in Western Ukraine and goes on to be involved with the historical commissions in the DP camps, and then he emigrates from Eastern Europe to New York and works with Selah Boron, also a very important historical figure for Lucy Davidovich. they all, Philip Friedman argued for writing history of the Holocaust from the perspective of the victims using Jewish sources, what he called Judeo-centric sources. And this is in contrast to some of the more famous books that are being published in the 50s and 60s. And not to disparage them, but they have a different project. And I'm thinking of Raoul Hilberg's The Destruction of the European Jews, which, by the way, Lucy Davidovich thought was an excellent book for what it was trying to do.
I was surprised by that. Right. I really was.
Right.
Yeah.
But she resents when he reissues it. Her problem is his reissue. So that book has a long and storied history. Hannah Arendt, by the way, was the reader on the book and gave it the kibosh. That itself is a fascinating story. But when you think of Hilberg, Hilberg is a painstaking, meticulous, I guess, extremely thorough investigation of what we would call the Nazi machine of death, right? That's what he does. Millions and millions of archives that he looked at. But he's interested in the perpetrator. How does a modern state do what it did, right? And he does it in an extraordinary way before anyone else did.
I do have to ask, Nancy, I wonder with Holocaust historiography, because she died in 1990, how she would have read some of the major works in the 90s and 2000s. So how she would have responded, let's say, to Browning, Christopher Browning, or to Goldhagen, or to Jan Tomasz Gross. How do you think she would have reacted to that?
Well, to Browning, we actually have evidence. And I, you know, partly because I'm not an historian of the Holocaust, it may seem strange. That's really not what I am. I mean, I did deal with her in the book. I do treat her Holocaust historiography, but I treat it as she's the American link in this Dubnovian tradition. And so I speak about The Golden Tradition, her first book, which is autobiographies and excerpts of Jewish first-person accounts, Jewish culture, as her representing Eastern European Jewry. That's what I call that chapter. And then I talk about the war against the Jews, 1933 to 1945, her major work. I call that Defending Polish Jewry. So I would argue that there's a, you know, she has a bias. I mean, we all do. But her project is to commemorate the East European Jewish past, to tell it what the civilization was like. She wants it to be a usable past for diasporic Jews, particularly American Jews who know nothing of the great civilization. That is, I think, what she's setting out to do. And I talk about her that way. You know, I think she reads his dissertation, or she reads the manuscript, and she doesn't like it. She doesn't like it. And to be fair to her, I would have to sort of revisit it. And it would be something to talk about at another time for me to think about, but she doesn't like it. About Goldhagen, I say in my epilogue, I do ask the question, what's the relevance of her intentionalism, a word that we haven't used here, her intentionalist view that the Holocaust, you cannot understand the Holocaust and the destruction of the Jews of Europe unless you understand the tenacity of modern anti-Jewish hatred, anti-Semitism, which is embedded, she believes, in Nazi ideology from the get-go and in Hitler from the get-go. She believes that ideas and men in power are some of the most significant, if not the most significant, motors of history. So she rejects structuralist, or what was then called functionalist, views of the unfolding of the war and of the final solution. So for her, ideology is what one needs to look at. And therefore, you look at Mein Kampf and you look at the prophecy in 1939. And even if there isn't a smoking gun that says we're going to round up Jews and kill them, and have them dig their own graves, from her perspective, that is embedded in the anathematization, the kind of rhetoric that's already there. So that's what she would say, is that, you know, you couldn't have a Holocaust without anti-Semitism. And I just want to say, for her, you know, she knows there's a conventional war going on. She understands that, but she's writing about the war against the Jews. And her point is that while the Germans, prosecuted a so-called imperialist war, whatever you want to call it, a war against the Soviets after they were no longer friends with them, but nonetheless, there's an ongoing war against the Jews, which was deliberate, systematic, and ideologically driven. And that's where she stands. So I actually say that Goldhagen, owes her something, even though his perspective is different. But that's kind of where he comes down. I mean, he goes, he says the whole society is anti-Semitic. And I actually think Saul Friedlander, who I revere, I mean, partly because I read his memoir when I was 16, I still thought it was just marvelous. But, you know, his newest books on the Holocaust combine perpetrator history and the voices of the victims. And he also emphasizes the centrality of anti-Semitism. And he emphasizes the Christianity of it all, which she does, which again was not in favor, not privileged in the 70s and 80s. You know, it was the idea that the modern German state was secular and there was a juggernaut of bureaucratic formation and they were fighting the Soviets and it was an imperial war and there was Lebensraum. But really, should we rethink Lutheranism? Well, actually, today people are rethinking Lutheranism. They're thinking about its embeddedness. So I think even if her craft of the 1970s doesn't meet our standards archivally today, doesn't meet our linguistic standard, you know, the field has grown and we have archival access in ways that we didn't, whether it's digital or in situ. But I think she asked some of the more important questions. And I would argue that many younger scholars or even older scholars, Yehuda Bauer, I'm thinking of just recently, kind of said there could be no Holocaust without anti-Semitism. This is Yehuda Bauer. And he tussled with her. So what I want to say is I think she asked the right questions. And the fact is that she was dismissed for a lot of reasons. One was gender. The other was she lacked a PhD. The third was, and, you know, to make sure people read my book, she lacked what I called sexual agency. She was an East European Jewish woman, barely 5 feet tall, who taught at a Jewish college. And that is not what gets you on the front page, although the war against the Jews was reviewed on the front page of the Times. But that's not what gets you on the front page of academic institutions today.
Yeah. And do you see, as a last very short question, when you talk toward the end of your book about her urgency or advocacy, urging Jews to join the Republican Party. I mean, how do you treat that, like, as a sort of legacy for the present? Can you describe
I don't. I punt here a little bit because she died in 1990. And I think one of the questions is this movement called neoconservatism had a certain shape in the crisis of the Democratic Party, you know, under Carter and then with Reagan. And, you know, the big question is, do we look at that and say they led to the Bush Doctrine? And did that lead to our contemporary Republican president, who I actually don't think is a Republican? I really don't. He happens to be at the head of the Republican Party, but that's because the Republican Party, in my view, wants to hang their whatever onto his whatever. I don't even want to go there, actually. But neoconservatism of her day was essentially Democrats who felt burned by the Democratic Party. And that had to do with the new left, with the perception of violence, with the attack on civil institutions that had been so fundamental to Jewish integration, the press, the academy, voting, things like this, which the English language, the canon, these things which had been the handholds for the integration of immigrant Jews into the mainstream. Those things came under the attack during the New Left, the counterculture, or the radical civil rights movement. And that's what burned her. And, you know, specifically the rhetoric of anti-Semitism and the rhetoric, the anti-Israel rhetoric that glorified the violence of the PLO back in the day. These things made her run scared. And that's what made those neoconservatives run scared. And exactly, I don't know where she would be today. I don't think it's my place. I don't think her political views are a legacy. I end my book with her legacy to Yiddish, if you will. She spends the last 5 years of her life raising money for the translation of Jewish literature. And I will tell you that just this year, the great memoir of Glickel, 17th century Ashkenazic woman who lived in the city of Hamelin in German lands, that great memoir that we have, which we never had a good English translation, was recently issued in English based on a fantastic scientific bilingual Hebrew-Yiddish version. And the funds for the translation of Glickel's memoirs were provided in part by Lucy Davidovich's Fund for the Translation of Jewish Literature. So I guess that's the part of her legacy that I think is very worth holding on to.
Yeah, and that's a remarkable tradition that I wish in some ways that it would be in your title, Lucy Davidovich Yiddishist, because it is such an integral part of her identity. So we've been talking with Nancy Sinkoff, who is a professor at Rutgers University. I'd like to give you a chance to answer our traditional question here on New Books Network. So takeaway points of the book, hopes for your listeners, and what you're working on right now.
Well, I think the biggest takeaway, which probably, not the biggest takeaway. One of the things I want people to take away with is that Jewish history is long. And all history is long. We go backwards. But that the historian of the modern period, at his or her peril, ignores, if you will, the long Jewish past. So this is, the book is an homage, if you will, to a certain method of studying history, which is la longue durée. And I'm very grateful, although it took a long time and my training was long, that I was trained by people who believe that if you want to study, in this case, Jewish history, you are best served by investigating and exploring and examining its long, long past. And it will give you the tools to understand seemingly, you know, unrelated phenomenon of the modern period. So that's sort of, I guess, a methodological takeaway. But it's so important to me because part of the book is a challenge to the perspective that Jewish politics must be liberal. Whatever I believe about American politics or what I hope for this democratic nation is one thing. But as an historian, it would be dishonest and frankly bad history if I or anyone else were to assert that there's only one Jewish politics. And the idea that there's a Jewish political tradition is bad history. You always need context and to ask the question of how did Jews behave politically? What were their avenues for political negotiation, strategies, movements, parties, ballot box, or none of the above? So, you know, that's a takeaway sort of, again, as a large, you know, a big takeaway. People need to think more in a more sophisticated way about the way that we perceive Jews and politics. So if they see movement of certain groups of Jews to one way, or they interrogate the politics of the modern state of Israel, there's nothing un-Jewish about those things. They may be politics you disagree with, but not on the grounds that they're not Jewish, because there's no essentialized Jewish politics. So that was important to me. It is important to me. What's the other takeaway? I don't know. You know, archival history is the best, but you better be prepared for a long haul. Better be prepared for a long haul, because you don't know what you're going to find in the archives. And if you're like me, you go down a lot of rabbit holes. It's just what I do.
And that seems to be the perfect sort of moment in our, you know, post-truth universe to insist that people go back and read the documents and read them in all of the languages and all of the places, especially if you have a biography. I want to thank Nancy Sinkoff for joining us today. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, on the New Books Network here at New Books in Eastern European Studies. Nancy Sinkoff is professor of history at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and she is the author of what I would call the most comprehensive and I think fascinating intellectual biography I have read. It is called From Left to Right, Lucy S. Davidovich, The New York Intellectuals and the Politics of Jewish History, published by Wayne State University Press in 2020. I want to thank you and congratulate you on the book today.
Thanks so much. I'm very pleased, I have to say. An unusual posture for me, but yes, I'm pleased. Thank you so much.